Welcome to Tiny Voice Talks with me, Tori Bono. And today we are talking about journeys through leadership or journeys to leadership, because going into leadership is not always a straightforward journey. And my guest today, Adam Woodward, is going to share his experience in the hope that actually navigating through his journey and what he's learned will help others. So welcome, Adam.
Hello, Tori. Thank you very much for having me today. I'm really looking forward to talking.
I'm really excited about it because I know that your path hasn't necessarily been a straight one. I know you've written about it in the TES about relationships. Yep. You know, we're sort of sitting on the, well, we're in the midst of COVID. We've just got through another lockdown. You know, there are so many things that have actually, altered probably the paths that you have been on. And I'm really grateful to have this conversation with you today.
Thank you for having me.
For those people that haven't come across Adam Woodward, who is Adam Woodward?
Adam Woodward is Director of Studies and Developing Curriculum at a school in Kent. I am a dad to a little boy, a husband as well, and first and foremost, really, I'm a teacher who wants the best for all the pupils that I interact with, really.
Yeah.
And staff as well, should I say.
Well, yeah, I think the two are so connected, aren't they?
Yeah.
So did you always want to become a teacher? Was that a sort of thing that you decided on early on?
Yeah, from probably by the time I was looking at university and what I wanted to do once I left school, path that I decided I wanted to take was I did a geography degree because that was something that really interested me. And then I was always going to do a primary PGCE after that. And geography was always kind of like, if teaching doesn't work, then I want something to fall back on. And geography was very wide ranging. Teaching was always the path that I wanted to go down. I had lots of teachers at school who looked after me and looked out for me. I wasn't always the best behaved student at school. I was always the one that ended up in the heads.
That surprises me.
Yeah, I know.
You look like you'd be really, really well behaved.
No, I was a really troublesome child when I was at school. And my mum was at her wit's end with me, always having letters sent home. But I had so many teachers actually supported me and kind of got me to university and got me into that position that I felt that was something that I kind of wanted to pass on.
It's really important, isn't it? And I always find these conversations fascinating because I always assume everyone's incredibly well behaved at school.
No, not me, unfortunately.
So did you go into secondary or primary?
Primary. So primary was always the aim. I knew what I was like as a secondary school child, and so I didn't know whether what...
You thought I wasn't...
No, I'm not yet. I don't think I'm going to cope. So primary, I felt I'm quite tall. And so I felt that I could impose myself. Obviously, I've learned a lot since then. I could impose myself and not feel so worried about children who were taller than me as they're growing up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that as an idea. Yes, I will choose to teach people that are definitely going to be shorter than me.
Yes.
So what year groups did you teach?
Oh, so I started in year one, believe it or not.
So you really went for the shorter person.
Yes, I did. I got to a time where I really panicked during my PGCE. I was like, I need a job for September, and was just applying left, right and centre. And this one just came up and stuck. Mm. And then I moved back home and taught in a school in year three for a couple of years, which was great. Mm-hmm. And then I've kind of gradually moved up through primary to year five and then year six as well. And year six kind of stuck for quite a while and really, really enjoyed that.
So you've actually covered a number of the year groups.
And that from today, I've taught every year, well, apart from reception early years, I've now taught every year group across the school, which I'm rather pleased about as I've had a range of experiences.
Have you got a favourite one?
Year six. year six has always been huge for me, and kind of it was the beginning of that leadership journey started with when I went into teaching to year six and looking at end of key stage two data and reporting back and seeing the transition that children make from primary to secondary as well. it's a great, great year group. I know everyone's got their favourites and they'll all be different at different ends of the school, but year six for me is like no other year group really for me.
It's funny. I think everyone that you speak to, you know, does have the year group that they really, really resonate with. Mm. But you touched there on it was the beginning of your leadership journey. Yes. Did you always? So I'm always interested in whether when people go into teaching, they view it as a journey to leadership or whether the journey to leadership is something that just happens subsequently.
It's a really interesting one. When I started teaching, I had this vision, oh, I'm going to be ahead by the time I'm 30. Very naive thought process. But then when I started teaching, I quickly realised that wasn't necessarily what I wanted to do and wanted to learn in the classroom and wanted to progress slowly. Like, it wasn't a race to the finish line. It certainly isn't. Yeah, leadership kind of, as I said, when I went to year six, kind of that leadership kind of was thrust upon me in terms of looking at that data and reporting back and trying to see the bigger picture, which, yeah, was really interesting. It kind of progressed from there. And then I became very career driven and wanted to improve and wanting to better myself. And I still do today. I feel that should always want to be better. For me, My feeling is if I wake up one day thinking I've got nothing left to learn, then that's the day that I kind of need to stop teaching and move on to something else, because I feel that we've all got something that we need to learn and can always progress and better ourselves.
Absolutely. So tell me about your journey in leadership. And I apologise for the bell in the background. That is my cat.
That's right.
I apologise profusely to all listeners. I cannot throw her out of the room. I have tried. She refuses point blank to leave. And yes, she is. She has
jingling.
Bell.
Not a problem.
If the bell goes, I apologise profusely. I'll repeat the question again, seeing as the cat decided to disturb. I'm just really interested in then that journey through leadership that you've already undertaken. So you started off in year six. Where to then within the leadership journey?
So I ended up part of my previous school as part of the senior leadership team, focusing on end of key stage two data, and then became a staff governor as well, which was a really good experience. And then got to a point where I had to really make a decision as to what I wanted to do. And the job as head of maths came up at my current school. And that maths was something I was really interested in terms of primary curriculum and development. Mm-hmm. And so applied and fortunately got the job in my current school. And I was head of maths for 3 years and really enjoyed that, part of our leadership team in there as a core subject leader. And then
actually, can I just, I think that's really interesting, because I think sometimes people hold themselves back from applying for roles like that, so, you know, maths leader, because they're not already a current maths leader. And I think sometimes people think, oh no, I need to be doing that job to apply for another job. Would you agree, or is that...
For me, it was a case of, oh, am I ready for this? Have I got the skills? Have I got enough experience to do that? And it was kind of putting myself out there. I thought, if I don't put myself out there, then I'm never going to get that position. I'm going to have to wait for it to possibly come up in my current school, which I didn't think was going to happen. So I had to kind of take the plunge, as it were, and go for it. And what did I have to lose? Nothing. I get told no, sorry. And then look
great
at feedback.
Philosophy.
Yeah, look at the feedback. Make sure you get feedback from if you're not successful, and then work on that going forward. I think just a rejection, it doesn't have to be a death sentence, as it were. You can always look to better yourself and improve, and take experienced words and feedback to help improve your practice as well, in whatever position you find yourself.
I think that's really lovely. You know, rejection doesn't need to be a death sentence.
No, not at all.
Because all too often we think, oh my goodness, I didn't get that. You know, my goodness, you know, that's just the end of it.
Yeah, it hurts as well.
Right.
Yeah, it does. Of course it's going to hurt. You've put yourself out there and you've prepared wanting to go in and be successful. And sometimes it's just a case of, oh, there was someone better on the day, or there was someone better suited for the school, or they could offer something that none of the other candidates could. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you've done awfully. It's just that someone else might have been a better fit at that time and place.
Yeah. So basically your advice to all listeners is just go for it.
Yeah, definitely. What have you got to lose? You can only gain from experience and going for leadership roles. And I think it's really important that people feel that if they want to, and that's what they'd like to do, that they feel that they can progress.
Yeah. So you became head of maths at that school.
Head of phase came up as well. So I was head of maths and head of years 4 to 6. Mm-hmm. Then last year, just before the first lockdown, we were told that the structure of the leadership team was going to change, and this director of studies role was going to come up, and I'd have to reapply for that post, which was nerve wracking in itself. So I was always going to apply, because the way that it was restructured was it was going to be out of class, it was going to be focusing solely on curriculum, which was by this point was everything I wanted. I wanted to move away from just developing maths to looking at developing the whole curriculum across the school, and that was something that really interested me, and had no hesitation in applying for it. I also had a colleague apply for it as well, mm-hmm. and found out, and that was really nerve-wracking, and knew then that I really have to pull it out the bag if I was going to be successful, which again, fortunately I was. And the feedback I got was you didn't rest on your laurels, you weren't blasé thinking, oh, you've got this in the bag, like you can tell you've really worked hard for this and you really wanted it, and that shone through during the interview. So that was really pleasing, and that's the position I find myself in today.
So tell me about your love of curriculum, because I know it's a deep love.
Yes, so Twitter's really, really helped as well. So using Twitter and seeing so many inspiring voices out there, like Mary Myatt, Kat Howard, Claire Seeley, to name a small number, are absolutely fantastic voices to listen to and to learn from. And I feel that in schools today, obviously with the new Ofsted framework and changes where we're not just teaching to a test, we're actually developing a broad and balanced curriculum. And that I feel is really important. And making sure that children feel as though if they're not good at English and not maybe good at maths, but they're good at other areas of curriculum, and that's where their passion lies, that they feel that subject has equal weighting in the curriculum, and that children can feel inspired across the curriculum and not just focusing on those core subjects that are maybe tested on at the end of a key stage.
Absolutely. So have you started then to review your curriculum in school?
Yes, we started to, and then lockdowns happened, and it's been really interesting, because obviously I started that job in September, and we had a term of what, we're just coming back from the first lockdown, everyone was back in school. I wanted to adapt our practice, and I'd looked at the use of knowledge organisers in school and retrieval practice, learned a lot from Kate Jones and her understanding and her research on retrieval practice, which is amazing.
So I'm just going to stop you there, because... Yeah. Just in case any of our listeners, and I, my listeners probably shouting at me now going, of course we know these things, but just in case listeners don't know what knowledge organisers and retrieval practice is, what is a knowledge organiser simply, and what is retrieval practice?
So starting with retrieval practice. So retrieval practice is the ability to be able to recall information from long-term memory into short-term or working memory, to be able to use and apply whenever needed. And it's about training the brain to embed that knowledge. And so there are lots of different strategies and techniques that you can use to embed that learning and train the brain as such, because working memory can only hold so much at once. And so by using retrieval practice within the classroom, then you can embed that learning further and then recall it when you need to. Knowledge organisers are maybe just one way of kind of using that in the classroom. So knowledge organisers are basically a sheet with key quotes, facts, dates, fact people across a unit that children can use to kind of self-assess and to help learn. So then all of that key information is there and doesn't necessarily need to be taught as such. It's there for them. And then the use and application of this knowledge can then be linked across skills as well, like use within an essay as such. So you've got that knowledge there, and then the skills can of writing that essay and structuring it can then be taught, but then you're implementing and putting the knowledge in place. So it's kind of, they work alongside each other. That's my personal view.
It's interesting because actually when you're speaking, I'm thinking that's really shifted. You know, knowledge organisers have really shifted the way that we teach, because it always used to be, you know, I'm going to impart all of this knowledge to you in about 10 lessons, children. Eventually, by the end of the 10th lesson, you'll know all of this knowledge and you'll understand all the vocabulary and you'll understand the dates. Yeah. But actually, knowledge organisers have somewhat turned it on its head by going, actually, I'm not going to spend 10 lessons teaching all of this information. I'm going to give it to you now.
Yes, I think that's really valuable. And when you've got a certain number of lessons to teach, say the Romans, for example, as a unit of work, if you've got all of that knowledge to hand as a starting point, then what you do is you can focus your planning and you can focus what you want the outcomes for the children to be in a lot more detail. And actually the children can walk away with a much better knowledge of what they've learned, and then where those links can be made as well. And I think Claire Seeley talks about it a lot with her 3D curriculum, about how links can be made across the curriculum and across year groups and across key stages as well, which I think is absolutely fantastic. And would love to achieve in my school at some day. Maybe now's not the right time with everything going on, which kind of comes full circle back into where I find myself at the moment, really.
So where do you find yourself at the moment?
Trying to support staff and support teachers as much as possible, whilst also I've got these ideals that I have in my head that I would like our school to eventually get to. At the moment, when my role started in September, teachers were just coming back into school and children were, we needed support, everyone making that transition back. And so we had a couple of things that we introduced, but we had to be very careful not to overwhelm teachers. There was a lot going on. Then obviously lockdown again happened at Christmas, and I was in the middle of doing my MPQSL at that point as well, and had to put it on hold because I felt that trying to run a whole school project, which was on attainment in maths and focusing on boys' attainment, looking at our data. But I felt that my leadership would have been a lot better suited actually supporting staff through lockdown and making sure they're able to offer the best education for our children possible. I felt that was a better use of my leadership than, right, I've got a whole school project that I need to complete to pass my MPQSL. You need to do this, that, and the other. And I didn't think that was very fair. And so it was really tough. And so I've put it on hold, and I think I've deferred and will try and start again at a better time. But for me, that leadership is not just curriculum-based, but it's also looking at teachers and giving them the tools to be able to offer the best education we can to our children, and supporting them wherever I can and wherever I can make a difference. That's what I'd like to do.
Well, what you're really saying is that leadership is reflective, and your leadership journey is a reflective one, in which it's not just about, right, I'm on this journey, this is where I'm going, this is what I'm doing, but, you know, I'm focusing on this. You're actually going, actually, is this appropriate? Is this right in this moment?
Exactly.
And I think that's incredibly powerful, because I think all too often we can think, actually, we're on this journey, we need to stay on this journey. And I know before this chat, actually, I shared with you about the idea of leadership being somewhat, you know, like going down a path and hitting a crossroads and then discovering that actually the way forward is blocked off and having to veer another way, but actually reflecting on which way's best.
Yes. And my head teacher at the moment is brilliant for kind of pulling me back to where I need to be, because I want to do all these things. And she said, she says to me, like, just stop and just think about where we are. We've got time, and it takes time to implement certain changes. And she's been great to help me be reflective of my own practice as well. She's been very good. And I've needed that, we've titled this Journeys Through Leadership. My journey is that we're all still learning. I'm still learning to be an effective leader and to be the best leader that I can. And sometimes I need to pull myself back. I can get rather enthusiastic about, what this would be great practice, and this would be great for our teachers, and it'd be great for the children. But sometimes it's a case of not too much too soon, and being supportive. And I've learned a lot from her. She's been fantastic. As has, I mean, I can talk about the benefits that Twitter's had on my practice all day long about looking at inspiring people. I know I've mentioned some people, but people I've had the opportunity to connect with and learn from their practice and their experiences, such as yourself as well. It's been great and really helped me to remodel kind of where I am and what my thoughts are and what I want to be as a leader, and how I might kind of, like, without going too deep, I want my legacy to be going forward.
But I think that is that deep, because actually I think every leader needs to consider that, you know, what do you want your legacy to be, and that's why I think it's so important that, you know, leaders have some form of coaching so that they are able to reflect on what's important to them.
And completely agree.
Going forward. I've got another question though. Just am interested in, you said that you can be quite enthusiastic.
Yes.
How have you found that as a leader? Has that always gone down well with staff if you're bouncing around the place, or have you had to temper that somewhat?
Yeah. I mean, going back to my previous school and 2, 3, 4 years into my teaching career, my last head teacher used to call me puppy because of my boundless enthusiasm. And obviously probably wouldn't get away with that now, but she could see my passion and my enthusiasm for everything that I did, and wanted me to be able to bottle that up, because if she could bottle it up and sell it, she'd be a millionaire and could retire happily. Yes, it can be tricky. When I started my head of maths role, I had this vision. And I knew what I wanted to do. We were going to change the scheme of learning and move towards a different curriculum and the way that things were introduced. And I had all of these things. And upon reflection, it was a bit too much for some and a bit too soon. And I mentioned that when I was in my interview for my director of studies role. I said, if I could go back, I'd probably do things a little bit differently and maybe not try to change so much so soon. Because a lot of staff were really on board, which was great, and they could see my enthusiasm. But there were some who found it really tricky and kind of needed that support and coaching to help to make that transition and make those changes. And some didn't want to, because I'm sure we've all come across teachers before, like, well, I've always done it this way and I want to carry on doing it this way. And it's a case of, we sometimes need to adapt our practice, and some didn't want to. So that was a learning curve for me as well.
And sometimes people don't want to, not because of any sort of overt, I don't want to, it's because they don't necessarily understand the benefits of going a different direction. And I think a good leader then is the one that will, which you touched on, actually takes the time to go back, explain and involve those members of staff so they feel part of and they feel empowered moving forward, as opposed to it being done unto them.
Yes. I mean, one thing as well I've learned is about making sure try and get that buy-in and needing kind of champions to champion something and to start something off. And if you have one or two that really buy in and are champions to something that you want to put in place, and they can, and then other teachers can see how that's benefited and how that's worked, then they'll come on board slowly and surely. And it doesn't have to be a race to the finish line and, oh, everyone's going to do this straight away. It's just a case of, maybe sometimes slow and steady wins the race. as the saying goes, and getting people and to buy that- in and move on slowly can have more benefits in the long term than just throwing something out there that everyone has to do.
And I'm sure that there are many established leaders listening to this that are nodding their heads going, yes, actually, that's one of the things that I learned.
Yes.
Because I think as a new leader, you're so excited and you do go at everything. Going, oh, my gosh, let's do this, let's do this, let's do this. And I know that I've done it. It is one of those things. It's a real learning curve to go, well, actually, do you know what? It is that slow and steady wins the race.
Yeah.
Be the tortoise, not the rabbit, not the hare.
Yeah.
You know, it's so, so vital. I wanted to just touch on the fact that there was another sort of change in your leadership journey earlier on this year, because you said that whenever you took on the September role, you were out of class, and then that's changed again. So how's that?
Yeah. So coming back from lockdown 3 or 2, whichever one it is for people, the last lockdown and coming back into school, we had a couple of members of staff who couldn't come back. And I was one of only a couple of leaders who didn't have a teaching commitment. We had a job share in year 2, and one of the job shares had an MA in reception, and our reception teacher was one that couldn't come back in after lockdown just yet. And so she was moved into reception, which opened up a teaching role in year 2 for 2 days a week. And my head said, oh, Adam, this would be great for you. We'd really like you to do this. And actually, I was really excited with my role. It was supposed to be helping to run interventions and support children, but I couldn't do that because of crossing bubbles and all sorts. Mm. And so my role wasn't what it was meant to be. So being able to actually be back in the classroom and teach year 2 was great. It was the only year group I'd never taught as well. So I've now taught every year group, which I'm quite chuffed about. And so going into year 2, it was last week, were my first 2 days, and I absolutely loved it. I said to my head afterwards, she knowing that I've predominantly taught year 6 over the last few years, and as I said, it's probably my favourite year group to teach. I said to her that she might have to drag me out kicking and screaming by the end of this, because I've absolutely loved being in there. So it's there was such lovely children, it made me feel so welcome. And again, talking about boundless enthusiasm, I had a whole class full of enthusiastic children who just wanted to please and wanted to learn. It was so lovely. So I thoroughly enjoyed my first 2 days in there, and looking forward. Yeah, I'll be back in again next Thursday and Friday, and looking forward to being back in as well.
I love that. I really do. And actually, I've written down words as I'm chatting to you about your leadership journey. And I've written down reflective.
Yeah.
And I've written down flexible. Mm-hmm. And I've written down responsive.
Yeah.
Would you add any other words, do you think, to that list? Because actually, leadership are those, you know, things, reflective, flexible, responsive. What else do you see as leadership?
So it's a change. And without this bit sounding like a plug, I wrote something recently for TS that I've had as my pinned tweet about.
You can plug away. This is your show. Far away. Plug as much as you like.
So I was it was a really proud moment for me. I had my thoughts published by TS in February about changes in leadership. Or changes in a role within leadership and how that changes relationships that you've had with people. So if you've been working at a school for a few years and then a leadership position comes up that you're successful in, how does that change your relationship with your colleagues that you've got relationships with? And it's a really tricky one. And when I was writing it, I was asked to make sure that I ended by giving some advice. And it's really tricky. So I kind of left it with two options. The first option being like you can be really honest with your colleagues who have become your friends over the years and before you start your leadership role, and say, look, this is work, and then that's one side of the line, and then personal is the other side. And the other option is maybe to move to a different school, to to keep those relationships with your colleagues and those friendships whilst also forming new relationships as a leader in a new setting. Mm. And for a lot of people, that might be the best way to go. For some people, staying in your current setting and your relationships are strong enough to be able to wade through the leadership mire sometimes when you're having those difficult conversations with people. And that's what it stems down to, because ultimately you're going to have a difficult conversation with a friend and a colleague sometimes. Yeah. And it's how that's managed. But I think I'm talking to a couple of people since then. It's about being authentic and people seeing you for who you are. And sometimes when people go into leadership, they lose that identity, and they maybe aren't seen as being as authentic before because they've got a new role and they can't see the wood through the tree sometimes. And it's really tough. And I know I've had experiences of before where it's been difficult to see that that relationship change. Yeah. I've been on both sides of it, seeing the leader and being the leader as well. And relationships do change, but it doesn't have to be the end of the world. I think there are lots of options out there for leaders to still be able to lead properly and build effective relationships as well.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think what you're saying is that actually authenticity and courage are absolutely there, that actually people need to be, you know, leaders need to be authentic, but they also have to have courage to have those tricky conversations and not, you know, and not people please as such.
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, leaders, teachers in the classroom, support staff, whoever it might be, at the end, we've all got the same goal, and that is for positive outcomes for our children. And I don't think anyone goes into the role with any other thought process or any other desire for any different outcome. But so, yeah, everyone's got the same objective, which is to think about the children.
And
how that comes about. I think as long as you're honest and you have in those conversations, I think that people can see where you're coming from. But like we said, being authentic and having integrity as well is vital to maintain those relationships.
So I've now built my list. I shall tell you my list now. So leadership and education, reflective, flexible, responsive, authentic, courageous, and child-centered.
Perfect.
And that's what your journey has been in leadership. And I'm really excited to see where it goes next.
I'm going to write those down as well. Thank you. I'm going to have them. I'm going to have them put on my wall in my room. And so I can always refer back. I will always refer back to them. So I will definitely write those down. Thank you.
Well, I think it's really worthwhile, you know, I'm going to actually plug now. If anyone hasn't heard Matt Duchesne's podcast with me, which is Authenticity, we discuss values on there. And I think it's so important to actually unpick our own core values and our own core value set in order to know who we are.
Matt was one of the people that I spoke to about my article, actually, and we spoke about authenticity. He was a great support and a great help, actually.
He is his little star.
He is.
He really is. Now, my final question, as everyone knows, is if you could have been taught by anyone at all, they could be alive, they can pass away, who would have been your perfect teacher?
I've actually got two. I did have one, but I've actually got two.
That's cheating slightly, but I'll let you have two.
So the first one, it would be Gary Barlow.
Because interesting choice.
Talking about buy-in and being authentic. I've never been very musically minded, but I feel that he could teach me to be very musically minded. He gets that buy-in from people, and people see him as being a great role model. So I think he would be great. Secondly, for anyone that knows me, I very much love my Marvel Cinematic Universe and very much a fan of Tony Stark. I feel that
it's a bit of Marvel, and you definitely can't, but it'd be a bit of, you know, Iron Man.
Exactly. So Tony Stark being having all of this knowledge and understanding and building something from nothing. Obviously, he's got the money behind him to be able to do it, but his attitude and his persona are fantastic and so engaging, and maybe come across as arrogant sometimes. I don't want that side of things, but I think, yeah, I would love to be taught by him and him passing down some of that knowledge to me. So those would be the two very different ends of the spectrum, but maybe meeting somewhere in the middle of Gary Barlow and Tony Stark.
Nice. Good choices.
Thank you.
Adam, it has been fantastic talking to you today, and I know you will have helped so many of the listeners really consider their leadership journey, giving them courage and actually to really think about their values. Thank you so much for coming on and chatting to me.
Thank you, Toria. Much appreciated. Thank you very much for having me. I really, really enjoyed it.